No one disputes who shot Diane Smith MacGyver.
One fact you are not going to have to decide is did Tex shoot Diane? Yes, he did.
Diane was a 63-year-old businesswoman and self-made millionaire. She was a fixture in Atlanta society, along with her husband. She and Claude Tex MacGyver had been married for 10 years and together for nearly 16. The two were thought of as the perfect couple by their friends.
You are going to hear from multiple witnesses that they had a relationship that people were envious of, that they seemed like lovebirds even after 10 years of marriage, that Tex adored Diane, that she loved him, and that they were clearly proud to be married to each other.
They took many trips around the globe and would often spend weekends away from Atlanta at their Putnam County ranch. On the weekend of September 23rd, 2016, they headed down to the ranch with Diane's best friend, Danny Joe Carter. Tex made dinner on Saturday night and breakfast Sunday morning. Then the couple went golfing. After Diane beat Tex and her friend and business associate, Craig Stringer, on the course, Diane and Tex returned to the ranch to pick up Danny Joe. With the weekend away from the big city over, the three began the drive back to Atlanta in a white Ford Expedition. They stopped for dinner along the way with Craig. After finishing their meal, Danny Joe then drove the couple the rest of the way back to their Buckhead condo. The connector for I-20 to I-75 and 85 was being repaved. All eight lanes of traffic were at a standstill. Danny Joe and Diane decided to take the back roads. They exited on Edgewood and Diane guided her friend along the way. As they were going down the exit ramp, Tex interjected that he didn't think this was a good plan. According to Tex, he was concerned about their safety in the neighborhood. Danny Joe didn't recall seeing anyone dangerous, but Tex still wanted to be prepared. In an interview with police, Tex said he asked Danny Joe to pass him his gun, which was in the center console. The interrogation audio is a little difficult to hear, but anytime I play it in this episode, I'll recap what he says to police after.
And I quickly said, this is a big mistake, and we're in a place that we don't belong.
Right.
And, of course, here we are in an almost new SUV and two women in the front seat.
Right.
They made a couple of turns and things were not going well. And I said, we'll be on Piedmont shortly. And I said, I'd like to, if you don't mind, please hand me my gun.
Right.
And it was in the center console. We've had some break-ins in our office where the only thing they're looking for seems to be a gun. And so in response to that, I had wrapped my gun in a Publix grocery sack. So
okay.
If you open the console, you had no clue what you're looking at.
Right.
A flashlight and some stuff
like that.
So Diane reaches in, pulls it out, hands it back to me.
He said he told Diane and Danny Joe, this is a big mistake. We're someplace we don't belong. He asked Diane to hand him his gun, which was in the center console. He explained that the gun was in a Publix grocery bag, that he had put it in the bag because he had had some break-ins before, and so he wanted to hide it. Tex sat in the back seat behind his wife, with the gun in his lap. Diane told Danny Joe to make a right onto Piedmont. It would take them the whole way down to Buckhead, so she did. At some point along Piedmont, there was a boom. At first, Danny Joe thought it was an explosion.
And when you were at the red light, can you tell the jurors what happened?
Well, we were sitting at the light, and I had both hands on the steering wheel because it's a big vehicle. And I was watching the light, and I hear click, click, click. And I looked at Diane and asked her what she was doing. She said, I'm just making sure the door's locked. And she said, there. Like, it's locked. And I looked at mine, and my door lock was up. So I hit the button and locked the doors, and I said, no, now they're locked. And I think That's the last thing that she said.
Before?
I heard a big boom, and I didn't know what it was. I thought there was an explosion somewhere, but my head turned to the right, and I looked out the window and wondered where there was an explosion or if somebody behind us was getting ready to hit us or something had happened behind us. I did not realize that it was a gunshot right away.
Tex knew immediately the gun had gone off.
I immediately called out. I said, "Is everybody all right?" And Danny Joe said yes. And Diane, head was kind of slanted. She said, "I've been shot," words to that effect.
Okay.
And I immediately put my arms around her and tried to determine how bad it was.
He said he immediately called out and asked if everyone was all right. Danny Joe said yes, but Diane said, "I've been shot." He said he put his arms around her and tried to determine how bad it was. Diane had been shot in the back by Tex. There was no question.
"We are not telling you that the gun was sitting on the seat next to him and it accidentally went off. We are not telling you that the gun malfunctioned. No one is going to ask you to decide who was holding the gun when it went off. It was Tex."
While the who wasn't in question, the why certainly was. Initially, everyone said or thought that it was an accident. Atlanta police began to investigate. The more they investigated, the more versions of that night they got from Tex McIver. Every new version raised more red flags, and so they decided to dig deeper. The first set of charges against Tex reflected a careless, preventable death. But it didn't stay that way.
Somehow the defendant wants you to believe that the death of Diane McIver was an accident. But ladies and gentlemen, this was no accident at all. And the evidence will show that this was indeed murder.
This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 153. By now, I'm sure you've heard about Rothy's, this incredible company that makes stylish, sustainable shoes and bags. They're carefully crafted with eco-friendly materials like repurposed plastic water bottles and marine plastic. Pretty cool, huh? Rothy's shoes are incredibly comfortable with zero break-in period thanks to their seamlessly knit-to-shape design. And with so many styles to choose from, Rothy's shoes are the perfect way to add some comfort and style to your closet. And finding the perfect style is easy because Rothy's come with free shipping and free returns on eligible items. One of my favorite pair of shoes is from Rothy's, and I get compliments on them all the time. I have the Chelsea in Berry Lattice Stitch, and not only are they cute, but they're comfortable and even machine washable. Rothy's has transformed nearly 100 million bottles into beautiful shoes, handbags, and face masks. Check out all the amazing shoes, bags, and masks available right now at rothys.com/court. That's rothys.com, rothys.com/court. Style and sustainability meet to create your new favorites. Head on over to rothys.com/court today. Make taking better care of your health a priority and make it super easy with Care/of. Care/of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals by creating a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term. Here's how it works. You go to their website, takecareof.com, and take an in-depth but short 5-minute quiz about your diet, lifestyle, and health concerns. Some questions I answered included, how much sleep do I get and how often do I work out? It's like getting a one-on-one consultation with a nutritionist, all without leaving your house. Care/of then recommends a list of vitamins and supplements specifically tailored just for you. And you can follow their recommendations or adjust what you receive at any time. What you receive is totally up to you. You'll then get a customized box at your door with daily individually wrapped packets that are perfect for getting back into a routine. All of Care/of's products are formulated with good-for-you, clean ingredients that are backed by science. In my packs, I get these really great protein powders that are made of ingredients I can actually recognize. Court Junkies can get 50% off your first Care/of order. Go to takecareof.com and enter the code JUNKIE50. That's takecareof.com and enter the code JUNKIE50. Diane Smith and Tex MacIver were both very accomplished in their own rights before they entered each other's orbits. Diane had begun her career as a bookkeeper, working her way up to becoming the president of Corey Airport Services. Before she met Tex, she owned a condo in Buckhead, Georgia, an affluent part of Atlanta. She also owned her own home and a 5-acre ranch. She met her best friend, Danny Joe, decades earlier, when Danny Joe did her nails at a salon. The two forged a friendship. Danny Joe would do Diane's nails once a week, and then the two would go out to dinner. Danny Joe spent time at Diane's home and saw her through her first marriage and subsequent divorce. According to Danny Joe, Diane wasn't looking to get married again. But shortly before 2000, a man in Diane's building began pursuing her. He dropped a note underneath her door to introduce himself. The man was Tex MacIver, an accomplished attorney at Fisher & Phillips Law Firm. The firm had offices across the country. Tex had earned partner status at the firm and had been practicing there for over 40 years. Tex had also been married before and had gotten divorced. During his marriage, he had 3 children. Diane had none. Tex pursued Diane into a reluctant fairy tale. Once he finally won her over, he proposed to her in the middle of the woods. According to Danny Joe, he was trying to be as romantic as possible. The two had already been living together, combining their 2 Buckhead condos into one that took up half the 15th floor of their building. Their living room looked out over the Lenox Mall and at Christmas time had a magnificent view of the tree. Diane also enjoyed time at Tex's ranch in Putnam County. The ranch was just over an hour away from the busyness of Atlanta. There were horses, an area to shoot guns, and golfing nearby, an activity the two enjoyed together. Once they became serious and moved in together, Diane took on pet projects at the ranch. She would change the flowers out a few times a year. They designed and built a saloon. Everyone who knew them said the couple was incredibly loving and that Tex treated Diane like a, quote, southern gentleman. The couple were also godparents to one of their friend's sons, Austin. Diane did everything she could for him. He called her Mommy Di.
Did you come to have an opinion about how she felt about Austin?
Oh, she loved him like a son.
And in loving him like a son, how did she treat him?
Like a son or a grandson.
She took care of him?
Oh, yes.
Do you know whether or not she took care of some of his needs financially?
Yes, I do.
And what kinds of things would she do for Austin financially?
Well, she had a savings account for him because she had one. She was also my great niece's godmother, who is 6 now, and she and Austin are great friends. But I knew that she had a tutor that was there, Miss Johnny, on a regular basis, and her housekeeper, Phyllis Gable, would pick Austin up from school so that his mother worked and she didn't have to go and do that. And I think she even paid for some of the school.
Tex and Diane kept their finances separate from each other. After each of their divorces, they thought it was for the best. Diane had told one of her friends, Elaine Williams, her worst fear was not having enough money.
Can you tell the jurors, what is the worst thing What is the worst thing that Diane MacGyver told you could ever happen to her?
Is not having enough money to live off.
At the time of Diane's death, she was bringing in roughly $20,000 a month from various businesses she ran, in addition to her role as president of Corey Airport Services. She was meticulous with her money, but still generous. Danny Jo told the court about the trip she took with Diane. Diane liked to travel and enjoyed the finer things in life. But if a friend needed money, she would loan them the money, with interest or collateral attached. Here's Diane's friend Craig testifying about that in court.
As close as you were with her, did you know anything about any of the loans that she gave?
Not at all.
Nope. So as close as you were, she didn't share that with you, right?
I knew about the one she gave me.
Right. Because she would give you loans, right?
Very closely, I mean, yes.
Yeah. Did you have to pay them back?
Are you kidding? Yes.
Explain that to the jury, how she was about loans to her close friends. You got to sit up, Mr. Strickland. You got to face the jurors and talk to them.
It was always gentle when we were making the arrangements. It got heavier later.
And did she charge you interest?
Lots.
Danny Jo could attest to this, too.
Did Diane MacGyver ever loan you any money?
Yes.
In the 40-year history of your relationship with her, on how many occasions would you say she has loaned you money?
Over a dozen times, more than a dozen times. I've never thought about how many.
Okay, and just try to keep your voice up because you're trembling a little bit.
Okay, sorry.
You said about a dozen times.
More than a dozen.
Now, did you consider yourself to be her best friend?
Yes.
And can you tell the jurors when Diane MacGyver would loan you money, would she make you sign any documents or anything?
Oh, we signed documents just like you were at the bank.
You would sign documents just like you were at the bank?
Yeah, with collateral.
With collateral?
Yes.
Was she charging interest?
Of course.
Why do you say of course?
That was just the way that's just the way we did it.
Diane even loaned Tex money after Tex ran into financial trouble himself.
The partnership that he had in 2005 at Fisher & Phillips was gone. He lost his partnership in 2014 and was planning on retiring in December of 2017. And over the 3-year period, his salary dropped 54%. He had become dependent upon Diane. And over the 3-year period from 2013 to 2016, our financial expert, Mr. Dean Driscoll, will testify that he received $198,000 from Diane MacGyver. In addition to the $198,000 that he received from her, she gave him a loan for $350,000 in 2011. This wasn't a, hey, you can pay me back whenever you get the money. This was an actual loan with a promissory note. And the loan was secured by the ranch out in Putnam County. And based on his financial condition, the defendant would not be able to repay this loan. In fact, the evidence will show that in 2011, when she gave him the loan, it was due in 2014, and he hadn't paid it. So she renewed it, so that would be due in December of 2017. And the evidence will show that over that period, he made interest-only payments and never paid any money on the principal.
Tex's loan, however, did not have the amount of interest that the other people in her life had. She expected him to pay her back, but they were married after all. She even extended the amount of time on the loan because he hadn't paid it back during the time frame the two had originally set. While Diane lent money and was careful with her books, she didn't really discuss her personal finances.
Can you tell the jurors, when it came to Diane's finances, was she a private person about those things, or would she share her financial situations with you?
No, she pretty much kept them private.
She kept them private. Did you have any idea how much money Diane had?
No.
The last weekend of Diane's life was a rare occurrence. Danny Joe, Tex, and Diane planned to head to the ranch without Diane's godchildren, Austin and Ava, Danny Joe's great niece. Since it was just the adults, the three decided to ride there together. Danny Joe arrived at Diane's office that Friday afternoon on September 23rd around 4 o'clock. Tex showed up a little later. They had wine before leaving. Then the three headed out. According to Danny Joe, the couple seemed normal, and everything continued in normal fashion for the rest of the weekend. On Sunday, Diane and Tex had a 2 p.m. tea time with Craig Stringer. Danny Joe planned to stay at the ranch to ride horses with Tanner McKinney and Samantha Watson, the young couple Diane and Tex had hired to exercise and take care of their horses. Tanner and Samantha arrived before Diane and Tex left. Tex chatted with Tanner a bit before they left and made an unusual request.
Now, I want to ask you, if you recall having a conversation with Mr. MacGyver before he left with his wife to go play golf.
Yeah, he had asked me if I could take Danny Joe back home. And we couldn't. She lives in Atlanta and we live in Athens. And so I just said, you know, hey, man, we can. And he was like, oh, yeah. And that was it.
Okay. Now, can you tell the jurors, had you ever been to Danny Joe's house before in Atlanta?
No, I hadn't.
When he said that to you, did you even know where Danny Joe lived?
No.
In the 3 or so years before... while you had been coming to the ranch, had Mr. MacGyver ever asked you to take Danny Joe home?
No.
And so Danny Joe remained at the ranch after riding. When Diane and Tex returned, they didn't shower. All three had already packed their belongings so they could immediately head back to Atlanta. Diane drove the first part of the trip, with Danny Joe in the passenger seat and Tex in the back. Danny Joe told the court she remembered Tex and Diane passing back and forth a roadie, a tumbler full of red wine, on the trip. Along their route, they stopped in Conyers to meet Craig again, this time at the Longhorns for dinner. There was a wait for a table, and even though Danny Joe didn't drink, she suggested they wait at the bar. It was only 15 minutes or so before they were seated. Craig joined them at the booth. The dinner was fairly unremarkable. Danny Joe and Diane had a steak, Tex a salad, and there was a bottle of wine. Around 9:15 or 9:30, Craig paid the bill and the friends said goodnight. Danny Joe got into the driver's seat of the White Ford Expedition, since she was sober. Diane hopped into the passenger seat so the two friends could chat the rest of the way home. Tex got into the back seat and sat behind Diane. During the drive, the two women discussed Diane's closet and some politics. Then, at some point, the conversation turned towards Diane's in-house attorney, Ken Rickard. Rickard had accidentally fired his gun in his home office, causing him to lose hearing in one ear.
And y'all had been talking, one of the subjects you had been talking about on the way from Longhorn to Atlanta was that Ken Rickard had accidentally fired a gun in his office at home.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes.
And that Ken Rickard had accidentally fired a gun in his home and it went off and it kind of made him hard of hearing in one ear.
Yes, it did.
And... That is exactly what a subject that you were talking about when you were coming from Atlanta to, I mean, coming to Atlanta from Longhorn. But you knew Mr. Rickerton had unintentionally discharged a firearm.
The three drove on I-20 towards Atlanta. Shortly before they got to the interchange where Danny Joe had planned to exit, the traffic was at a standstill. She recalled just seeing 8 lanes of red brake lights. She wanted to get off the highway and asked Diane.
I think I asked her which way, you know, if we wanted to get off at this exit, but I wanted to get off that road.
Okay. And in getting off that road, did you have any idea which way you should go in order to get up into Buckhead? Did you know?
Not a clue.
Not a clue?
No.
How far is that exit from where Diane McGava worked at the Corey building?
Very close. So really? Yes.
Very close?
Yes. She had guided me on back roads around there before.
As Danny Joe was exiting the highway, Tex finally chimed in from the back seat.
And we were on the off-ramp. He said, girls, I wish you hadn't have done this. This is a really bad area. You should have just stayed on 85.
Even with Texas' concern of it being a bad neighborhood, Danny Joe didn't remember seeing anyone dangerous.
And did you see anyone when you were stopped there at the red light, anyone who appeared to be homeless or that was approaching the car or attacking the car or anything like that?
No.
Tex asked Diane for his gun, saying, "Darling, hand me my gun." Diane opened the center console, where Tex usually kept it. Danny Joe and Diane both looked down, not seeing the gun at first. Tex informed them that the gun was in a plastic bag, something Danny Joe had never seen him do before. During the trial, District Attorney Clint Rucker had Danny Joe step down from the witness stand to illustrate the positioning of everyone in the car. He had recreated the seats of the expedition, right down to the kind of seats. He had two of the other attorneys take the seats where Diane and Tex were sitting. The assistant DA stepping in for Diane handed Tex the bag with the gun inside. The bag was a light brown Publix grocery bag, and the gun was a .38 caliber snub nose. During the demonstration, Danny Joe noted that the console in between the two front seats was full of other things, so the gun was at the top. But that part was not recreated. The console was empty. The stand-in had to reach to the bottom to reach the gun.
Diane said, when he said, "Darling, hand me my gun," Diane said, "Tex, I don't even know where your gun is." And he said, "It's in the console." And she opened the console, and I looked down, and I didn't see it. He said, "It's in the plastic bag." And then she...
She what?
She picked it up and handed it to him.
Picked it up and handed it to him.
Mm-hmm.
Tex McIver didn't testify in court, but his interview with police was played for the jury. His version of getting off the highway and asking for his gun was similar to Danny Joe's.
I said, "Yeah, I'd like to. If you don't mind, please hand me my gun." Right. It was in the center console. We've had some break-ins in our office where the only thing they're looking for seems to be a gun. And so in response to that, I had wrapped my gun in a Publix grocery sack. So
okay.
If you open the console, you have no clue what you're looking at.
Right.
The flashlight and some stuff
right.
like that. So Diane reaches in, pulls it out, hands it back to me, and... by then, we may have been on Piedmont. Anyway, I'm relatively satisfied that we're out of that kind of area.
Right.
He described Diane giving him the gun and how it was in the Publix bag. But he said he was pretty satisfied as they continued driving that they were out of that kind of area. Danny Joe continued down the road until Diane told her to turn onto Piedmont. At first, Danny Joe didn't recognize it as Piedmont, and she did note that for the first time since exiting the highway, she saw people on the side of the road. The expedition continued down Piedmont for a few more blocks. Despite Tex's reported concern for the area, he told police he fell back asleep, the gun in his lap. Danny Jo remembered being stopped at either 12th or 14th Street when she heard the loud boom. Tex told police he realized the gun went off and then checked on the two women in the front seats.
Diane turned around, like, she turned around this way. She swung around and she says, Tex, what did you do?
Tex, what did you do? Mm-hmm. And did he say anything?
He said the gun discharged.
And so, what did you do when Diane MacGyver turned around to look?
When she turned around, I turned around and realized seconds. This was all happening in seconds. And I saw a puff of smoke, and I could see his hand, his hands. And I could see the top of the gun. I could see part of the gun, his hands, and some of the bag.
Okay.
And his hand was moving like this.
Danny Jo didn't realize Diane had been shot. And when she turned around, she saw Tex swiping his hand in a small back-and-forth motion above the bag with the gun. Again, District Attorney Clint Rucker relied on a demonstration in court, showing Diane's stand-in turning around and then facing back forward. Danny Jo said at first she thought Diane was going to lay into Tex for firing the gun. But moments later, Diane started making sounds that Danny Jo described as something she had never heard before.
Well, after she kind of went through the panicky thing that any of us might do if something, when you smash your finger and you kind of, because she was a panicky kind of person with that, she started making these noises that I've never heard before, and I thought she was dying. They were horrible noises.
All three cell phones were in the back seat with Tex. His own and Danny Joe's and Diane's were both in their purses next to him. But he didn't reach for any of them to call 911. He began holding Diane's head and saying her name. Danny Jo started for a hospital. At Tex's direction, she headed for Emory University Hospital, even though she thought Piedmont may have been closer.
And as you were sitting on Piedmont Road, understanding that Piedmont Hospital isn't on Piedmont Road, did you know how to get there from where you were?
No.
Did you express that thought to the defendant?
No, I just asked him where the closest emergency room was.
And what did he say?
He said, Emory, we should go to Emory. And I said, you're going to have to tell me how to go, which way to get there, because I don't know.
Danny Jo didn't know how to get to Emory on her own. By her own admission, she always relies heavily on GPS. To help show the jury the route, Danny Jo again got down from the witness stand in court. This time, it wasn't in a model of the car. Instead, there was a screen showing a live look at the streets she took. She told the jury how she drove at a frantic speed following Tex's directions. At one point, while trying to get to the hospital, Tex told her to slow down.
Told me I needed to be careful, that there might be people out there walking with baby carriages.
She didn't slow down. It was 10 o'clock at night, after all, so the likelihood of anyone walking around with baby carriages didn't seem very high. Finally, the expedition pulled up to the valet of Emory University Hospital. Diane was put into a wheelchair, and Tex shouted, "It's a gunshot." Here, Tex tells investigators about pulling up to the hospital.
And then when I get to the hospital, you know what happened next? I'll never forget as long as I live. As we pulled up to what's the door of the ER, mm-hmm. kind of a circular thing, I got out and yelled, "Gunshot wound." Anyway, people were scurrying around and a gurney comes out and I help them load Diane. At that point, she wasn't very responsive.
Okay.
And they rolled her in. And of course, I'm holding her hand going with her and we go into a room, maybe 30 in as big as this, and it is absolutely filled with people. I can't tell you how impressed
right.
I was. I mean, maybe 15 people.
And staff-wise?
Yeah, a blue of stuff. And I'm still holding her hand, and people are doing everything like you see on TV. And finally, this doctor turns to me. He's got the long coat, which tells you a doctor versus an intern.
Right.
He turned and said, "We don't have room for you anymore." And I knew then I was obstructing their efforts, and I moved outside.
He said he'll never forget it as long as he'll live. Diane wasn't very responsive, he said, and he was holding her hand as doctors and nurses swarmed around her. One of the doctors finally turned to him and told him they don't have room for him anymore, so he moved outside. When the medical professionals began working on Diane, she was still conscious and speaking. According to multiple staff members, she asked if she was dying. She also told Dr. Suzanne Hardy that she shot herself. It was an odd admission. The doctor tried to follow up. Diane added that it was an accident.
Can you tell the jurors what question did you ask Diane MacIver?
Once you know it's a trauma, you kind of go down a pathway. So the first question is just any medical history and then any surgical history. I don't know if I asked for allergies or not, but that's one of the next ones we ask about. And then I guess at the same time, then we were rolling her. So we were trying to determine any more of her wounds. So that's when I saw the other gunshot wound on her back and asked her, did you hear a gun? Or I asked her where the gun was held. And she said, I was holding it behind my back. In a trauma, you cannot determine the exit or entrance wounds. And so just by asking that question, you could determine where the entrance was.
Okay. Because you were trying to find out where the bullet went in.
Yes.
And when she said that to you, what did you say back to her?
Well, it just seemed odd that you could be holding a gun behind your back. So I just repeated it with you were holding it behind your back.
That's what you said back to her?
Yes.
And then what did she say?
She said, no, he was holding it behind my back.
Was there a time when Diane MacIver said other things to you after this?
That's when she said it was an accident.
Okay. And tell the jurors this. Was that in response to a question that you asked her?
No.
Before Diane was taken into surgery, the doctor asked her two questions.
First question, I told her I was going to intubate her, and I asked her if it was okay.
What did she say?
Yes, please.
Yes, please.
She was very polite.
She was very polite. What was the second question that you asked her?
Would you like to see your husband?
And can you tell the jurors, did she give you an answer?
Yes, she gave me an answer.
Can you tell them what the answer was?
No.
Diane did not want to see her husband. Coloring your hair in the comfort of your own home is something a lot of people are doing nowadays. But you might be nervous about it, wondering how you would find the right color, and then what about the cost? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. For decades, there were only two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon, but not anymore. Madison Reed's color is unique. It's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And finding the perfect shade couldn't be easier. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quick online quiz that will ask you questions about your hair, like what you want your end result to be, what your hair texture is, etc. Then they match you with your perfect shade. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. And now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm guessing you love true crime and mysteries too, which is why you'll want to check out June's Journey, a hidden object murder mystery game you can play on your phone. In the game, you're June Parker, and you're investigating the mysterious death of your sister and her husband. Police say it was a murder-suicide, but is that what really happened? Not only does June's journey have a compelling storyline, but it's also really fun to play. You can unlock clues by finding hidden objects and talking to various characters. I'm pretty new to the game, but I've already uncovered some clues into what really happened, including a mysterious photo of the crime scene. This game is great to play when you're looking to kill some time or just looking to relax and lose yourself in a good mystery. It's actually pretty hard to put down. June's Journey is free to download on your phone or tablet, and there are new chapters every week. Join the more than 30 million fans and unleash your inner detective. Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. While the medical staff treated Diane, Tex talked with Danny Joe. He told her to tell the police she was a family friend who had just arrived, despite the fact that she had driven the car.
He looked up and didn't look at me, but looked past me and said, I don't trust these guys. Danny Joe, I hate to see you get wrapped up in this. I've seen how these things can go down.
And when you say he looked past you, what guys were behind you?
They were uniformed people.
Did he say what he meant by that statement to you?
No.
Okay. What's the next thing he said?
I've seen how these things can go down.
Anything else?
You just need to say you came down here as a friend of the family. I leaned down and said, Tex, I just drove you into the emergency room.
And why did you tell him that?
There was no other reason. There was no reason for me to be down at Emory Hospital in Decatur, where I never go, with no car at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. You know, 15 minutes after his wife had been shot. How was I supposed to explain that?
And then did he say something in response to that?
He looked at me and he says, well, they don't know that.
And so what did you say?
Well, that took my breath away.
Tex then called his attorney, Steve Maples. Maples is a criminal defense attorney, and he was there within 15 minutes. Hospital staff observed Tex and Maples speaking. Some heard bits of conversations that were disconcerting. Others just found it odd. Nurse Terry Sullivan was one of them.
Could you tell the jury, what are the extra words that you heard?
This is what you're going to tell them.
Were there any other words that you heard?
It was a longer conversation. It was tell them. And then there was some other words, and then this is what you're going to tell them.
Okay. And so can you tell the jurors, at the time that you heard the group of people that included the defendant saying those things, were you aware that Ms. MacGyver had been suffering, well, was in critical room 2, suffering from a gunshot wound?
Yes.
And can you tell the jurors that statement that you heard, did it resonate with you, if you understand what I'm trying to say?
It did.
And so because it resonated with you, what did you do?
Well, I knew that we were very busy and that I wasn't in a position to be able to listen further. And I was concerned, did I hear correctly? This can't be happening. So I requested one of my colleagues to kind of hang out that was not an RN. She's a tech. So she's kind of able to be more mobile in the department to kind of hang out and see what she could hear to either corroborate what I heard or to hear further if there was, in fact, some kind of a inappropriate discussion going on.
Because that was the impression that you had, right?
No meeting.
What impression did you have when you heard that?
I had the impression that there was a plan being enacted. They were actually kind of huddling like you would think of a sports team, literally holding on to each other in a small circle.
Like a football huddle?
Yes.
The hospital staff tried for over an hour in the operating room to save Diane. But at around 1:30 a.m., she was pronounced dead. Tex told the police about the moment he found out. The worst moment of his life, he said.
You want to have the worst feeling in your life is to be sitting in one of those waiting rooms, two surgeons in scrubs and a chaplain come around the corner and start walking towards me. I actually looked behind me, hoping it was somebody else. And anyway, they took me into a room and explained things to me.
He said he was taken into a room and told Diane had died. He choked up as he spoke to detectives, calling her the love of his life. After the news of Diane passing, Tex was then treated there for anxiety. The nurse recalled him being extremely calm and not agitated. The doctor, however, had a different impression and thought he presented anxiety. Tex was prescribed Ativan. By the time Tex was discharged, Danny Joe's husband, Tom, had arrived to take them home. When they got to Tex and Diane's condo in Buckhead, Danny Joe stayed with him. She was worried how he would be alone. By this time, it was roughly 7 in the morning, and it was starting to get light outside. Tex made some calls to some of Diane's business associates to let them know about Diane's death. One business associate he called was Jay Grover.
He called me on my cell phone. I was at my fiance's house getting ready to get in the shower to get dressed for work, and my phone rang, and I answered it, and it was Tex.
Okay. And can you tell the jurors what did he say to you?
He said Diane's dead. And I said, what? What are you talking about? And the only thing I really recall after that is the words car and accident. And I don't know whether he said we were in the car and it was an accident or whether it was a car accident. I don't know. I recall the words car and accident. And he asked me if I would go tell Billy, meaning Mr. Corey. And I said I would.
Can you tell the jurors what was the demeanor in the defendant's voice when you were hearing him say that Diane is dead?
Frankly, I don't recall, Mr. Rucker. I think it was just matter of fact. He just said it.
The autopsy was completed the next day on the 26th. The cause of death, which was no shock to anyone, was a single gunshot wound. Over the next week or so, the investigation into the shooting continued, but no additional information was released to the public. Nevertheless, the case grabbed the media's attention. Tex, according to witnesses, wanted to get in front of the story. He hired a public relations person by the name of Bill Crane. Together, the two men crafted a statement about the accidental shooting to be released. Bill Crane spoke to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, or the AJC. He told the paper the Ford expedition had been approached by several individuals during a week where, quote, there were several Black Lives Matter protests in the area. He went on to say that the approach was at Peachtree and Piedmont, and to be safe, Tex had retrieved his gun. Crane also included that the couple had not been drinking and that the gun went off after the car hit a bump. The statement that Tex had hoped would clear up the matter only exacerbated the issue. Tex's attorney wanted the Black Lives Matter part completely retracted. According to Tex and Diane's friend, Jay Grover, Tex didn't understand why. Grover testified about a phone call he received from Tex during this time. He told the court any time Tex called him, he would put it on speakerphone so others could hear.
And could you tell the jurors what did the defendant say at that time?
We were finishing up the conversation about the SUV, and he said, "I've got to run. I got to go down and see my lawyers. They want me to get down to their office and see them right away." And you know, and I believe that I asked, you know, what's going on, and he said they're jumping up and down, and they say that I.
And you're about to use a bad word, aren't you?
I was going to use a bad word.
I want you to say exactly what he said.
He said, they said that I have fucked up the case.
And did the defendant tell you how he had effed up the case?
I said, what's going on? And he said, it's about this newspaper article that just came out. And I said, what newspaper article? I don't know what you're talking about. And I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And he said, oh, this article that's coming out about in the AJC. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And he said this one with Bill Crane. And he said, there's nothing wrong with the article. Bill and I vetted the article, and it's fine. I don't know what they're so upset about.
I want to make sure I'm very accurate about what he told you. Bill and I vetted the article. What else did he say?
And I don't know what they're so upset about.
2 days later, Tex spoke with the local media and laid out a slightly different story. He told the AJC he was worried about being carjacked, but not by a specific group. This time, he also said they had been drinking and that there was no bump in the road. It had been 11 days. No charges had been filed yet. The AJC and other news outlets continued to dig into Tex MacIver. They uncovered another shooting linked to him. This one was from back in 1990. On February 27, 1990, Tex MacIver lived in Northeast Atlanta on Cravey Trail with his first wife. He was represented by his same attorney, Steve Maples, for this shooting as well. According to Maples, when Tex arrived home around 9:30 that night, his first wife was alarmed by activity at the end of the street. He grabbed his gun and went to check it out. Three teenagers in a Ford Mustang began to drive straight at him, according to Tex, and so he fired at the vehicle. At the time, he was charged with 3 counts of aggravated assault. None of the teens were injured, and the parties settled out of court. At this point, there were still no charges filed in Diane's case, but Tex could feel that they were coming. He told Jay Grover, who was former law enforcement, as much.
When Tex knocked at the door, can you tell the jurors what happened?
Janie went to the door and opened it and said, "Hey, Tex," and "Come on in."
Okay. And did he come in?
He did.
Did you get a chance to see him?
Yes, sir.
Can you describe for the jury what was his demeanor when you saw him?
It seemed like Tex. Nothing. There was nothing remarkable that I recall.
Okay. So when he came inside, tell the jurors what happened.
When he sat down. He sat down in the chair. We all sat down. The the first thing that he did, he turned and looked over at me and said, Jay, can you believe they want to charge me with reckless conduct for this thing? And I was taken aback by that. I kind of stuttered and stammered, and I said, Tex, there's a, I mean, there, I think there's some elements of a crime here. I was a former police officer, and so I think there's elements of a crime here. I was actually shocked that would be the first thing out of his mouth.
The investigation continued behind the scenes, and Tex's behavior continued to become more odd to those who knew him. For one, Diane's remains had been sent to Phoenix Funeral Services. In her will, she had said she wanted to be cremated. The funeral home called Tex when her ashes were ready to be picked up, but he didn't come. After a week of no response, Phoenix Funeral Services tried him again. Tex told them he was waiting for the estate to be probated so the estate could pay for the cremation. The cost was $1,600. A month later, October 28th, Diane's ashes were still at the funeral home. At this point, one of her friends decided to pay for and pick them up, not wanting her to continue to be at the funeral home. She didn't ask to be paid back. She only wanted a memento of Diane's. The cost of Diane's cremation wasn't the only unusual thing Tex did regarding money during this time. Danny Joe recalled once they had arrived back at the condo, the very next day, Tex had started to catalog Diane's belongings. By December of 2016, Tex had put together an estate sale. The sale lasted several days, and thousands of people were in attendance. The sale included Diane's clothing, jewelry, her furs, and much more.
After Diane McIver died, less than a week after she died, the defendant began to inventory all of her belongings. Her jewelry, her clothes, her hats, shoes, everything that she had, he began to inventory it so that he could sell it. And what the defendant told media outlets and journalists is that he was doing this in order to satisfy the bequest in her will. And he had an estate sale and an auction and raised over $187,000. And the evidence will show that to this date, not one of those bequests have been paid.
Tex said he was following his attorney's orders by having the sale. They recommended doing it in the winter so that the clothes, specifically the furs, weren't out of season. He also said he did it because of stipulations in Diane's will.
And the auction was held because Diane made specific requests in her will. There were people that she identified that she wanted to receive money, people other than Tex McIver. And the money needed to be raised to satisfy those requests.
Danny Joe still found it odd. Tex was referencing a will from 2006. She knew her friend had planned on making a new will because in 2006, her godson Austin had not yet been born. Tex, not having a copy of a new will, presented the 2006 one to probate court. It was that will's instructions he said he was following. Danny Joe told the court she asked him about a new will.
And what did you say to the defendant about that 2006 Diane McIver will? What did you say to him?
That she wouldn't be very happy with it.
That's what you said?
Yes.
And then what did he say back to you?
he told me that they had made appointments to change the will, but that he had had to cancel the appointments.
I thought you told us earlier Diane was pretty good about appointments.
She was emphatic about appointments.
Say that again.
She was emphatic about appointments.
And who did he say had canceled the appointments to have the will changed?
He said that he had.
He did. Can you tell the jurors, did you say something else to him?
Just more about that she would be disappointed because Austin was not even born before 2006. And we had talked about that a lot, about Austin and the ranch. And that there were some people that were in the will that she hadn't spoken to in years.
On December 21st, nearly 3 months after Diane's death, the district attorney's office finally filed charges against Tex. The charges were involuntary manslaughter and reckless conduct.
Months later, in December 2016, he is arrested. He is arrested for reckless conduct and involuntary manslaughter. He is not arrested for murder.
Tex was surprised by the charges. After all, Diane had told her doctor it was an accident. Tex had told people it was an accident, although his details surrounding the accident kept changing. Even Danny Joe had said it was an accident. Tex was released on bond while his defense team began working on his case. But the district attorney's office wasn't done looking into the case either. 10 days after he was charged, news of the $350,000 loan between Tex and Diane surfaced. It prompted police and the district attorney to look further into Tex's financial records. The district attorney's office subpoenaed his financial records. The $350,000 was just the tip of the iceberg. His company had sent him an email detailing problems with his shrinking billable hours. According to the prosecution, Tex was simply living a lifestyle that he couldn't afford. When all was said and done, between his income and debts in September 2016, Tex was negative $5,000.
Defendant did have a pension, and our expert would testify that based upon his spending habits, it would be depleted in 2 years after he retired. And in addition to that, without the money from Diane that he was receiving every month, on the time of her death, the defendant wouldn't even have $1. As a matter of fact, without Diane's money, on the day that she died, his account would have been negative over $5,000.
That negative would turn into $1.1 million upon Diane's death. It was enough of a motive for the prosecution to add a more severe charge of malice murder, but it wouldn't be the only charge they would add. Prosecutors didn't just look into Tex's financials. They re-interviewed everyone from hospital staff to business partners to friends, including Danny Joe. Danny Joe told prosecutors about how Tex wanted to keep her out of this mess, a fact she told the jury happened that night, but she hadn't told anyone for several months. On top of the new murder charge, prosecutors added the charge of influencing a witness. It was a charge that would have new examples accompanying it by the time the murder trial would begin in 2018, nearly a year after the new charges were filed. In this episode, we've covered what happened that night in September 2016 and the initial investigation that followed. Next week, the conclusion. I'd love to know what you think so far. Do you think it was an accident or was it murder? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Polly Katowski with Law and Crime. You can follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Polly Katowski. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads and hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. And be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/courtjunkie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. If you guys haven't yet checked out the Jordan Harbinger Show, you are really missing out. It's a podcast you really should be listening to, and I'm not kidding when I say that Court Junkies will especially love it. Jordan's show, which Apple named one of its best of 2018, is aimed at making you a better informed, more critical thinker, so you can get a sense of how the world actually works and come to your own conclusions about what's happening, even inside your own brain. Each episode is a conversation with a different, fascinating guest, and there is something for everyone here. In one episode, Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you. Another episode tells the story of a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. One of his more recent episodes was with Bruce Sackman, a renowned investigator who tracks down serial killers. Another was with Thomas Erickson, a behavioral expert who talks about how to identify psychopaths. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.